Hello, I'm Charles Goddard. This is number 0329, the Stop File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0329. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we have a return visit from William Chalmers, who is the event manager for the Global Scavenger Hunt. The next trip is the 12th annual one.
I originally thought this was a once-in-a-lifetime thing, but now we have Global Scavenger Hunt groupies that come back every year because this is the way they want to experience the world, and they love the competition, they love the camaraderie with their fellow travelers from around the world, and they love the blind date aspect of it. We're going to go around the world in 23 days and visit 10 countries, but we don't tell people which 10 countries we're going to. That's a very exciting time for people. It's not so great for type A's who like to plan and be in control, but for people who love serendipity and are curious, it's an exciting situation.
Ed Meyer from Ripley's Believe It or Not is also back on the program. He shares some holiday stories from their archives.
The Lapp people of Lapland, northern Finland and northern Norway, are treating their reindeer with glow-in-the-dark paint on their antlers to prevent them being hit by cars and traffic at night. So Rudolph may be out of a job real soon. If we've got antlers that glow in the dark, we could do the whole sleigh and be a little bit brighter than just one nose.
Film reviewer Dennis Perkins talks about the death of video stores, a place he worked for 25 years. It's the end of an era.
Going to a video store, like going to the movie theater, is a conscious choice that you make, a commitment to a movie. You go and you look and you talk and you pick it out and you choose it and then you take it home. It's an appointment. It's a commitment you make based on a conscious choice. Whereas, as with cable and with TV and with the internet and with everything else, movies on streaming are generally they're what's on. You're a lot less likely to have as strong a connection, I think, to movies that are online.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0329, was Charles Goddard, my brother-in-law, and also my first boss back in the day when I was a teenager, when I worked as a theater usher. Thank you very much, Chuckles, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? An Indonesian man allegedly not only killed his wife's alleged rapist, but also cut off his penis, cooked it, and ate it. After learning that his wife wasn't a virgin anymore as a result of being raped, Rudy Effendi reportedly decided to seek revenge on the woman's attacker. According to Agence France-Presse, the 20-year-old told Effendi that she had been raped while she and the suspect were dating. The wife then lured the rape suspect for a meeting. There, the man was met by the 30-year-old Effendi, who allegedly stabbed the dude to death before severing, cooking, and eating his penis. From there, the man's body was left in his van, which was set on fire. According to the Malaysian Daily Tribune, the victim was found with cuts to his face and ear, in addition to the, you know, severed Johnson. Yeah. I was so mad at him for raping my wife that I planned to kill him, Effendi allegedly commented. I ate his genitals to assuage my fury. I did it all by myself. My wife had nothing to do with this. Despite his anger, he holds that his wife had nothing to do with the crime, something police contest. Police also told Agence France-Presse the case is still under investigation, but we strongly suspect that this is a premeditated murder. You figure? This is one of the exotic dining stories, by the way, that I don't want to hear the term, tastes like chicken. Yeah. A new church has opened in Spring, Texas, the Greater Church of Lucifer. We have gatherings, but they're not services, said Michael W. Ford, church co-president. We don't preach. We don't have something that we try to tell people this is reality. They don't sacrifice animals, he says, worship the devil, or try to convert Christians. Still, area Christians were outraged. Outraged, I say, and picketed the church in force. We are all Christians here, together against this, said protester Christine Week. We ought to be able to fill the whole street here that they have to pass through us to get to that church. Now, Ford was philosophical. They have a right to do what they want to do, he said, and that's cool with us. But we have the right to believe in what we do, too. That wasn't good enough for Week, though. This is what we get when we have freedom of religion, she complained. She complained? Wow. Clearly, she's missed the point. Thank the deity of your choice that people do have the right to freedom of religion. Anyway, watch your language, folks. We've got a couple of items here that highlight that. Number one, recently added to the list of words and phrases to be officially discouraged on campus, according to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's website, political correctness. The phrase is said to be a microaggression that might make some students feel uncomfortable or unsafe if they hear it or read it. So let me get this straight. It's now politically incorrect to say political correctness. My, we are definitely following Alice through the looking glass, aren't we? And number two, in November, the University of Vermont held a voluntary 3-day retreat open only to students who self-identify as white so that they can study the implications of white privilege in society. For example, what does it mean to be white? And how does whiteness impact you? I got nothing to add on that one, but you put those two stories together and you have to ask the question, what the heck is going on college campuses these days? Seriously. Anyway, an officer from the University of Iowa Department of Public Safety stopped a car going the wrong way down a one-way street at 3 a.m. in Iowa City. 39-year-old Ross A. McDonald was extremely confused and unaware he was on a one-way street. That's what police say. He was arrested on suspicion of drunk driving after failing a field sobriety test. At the police station, McDonald started eating toilet paper in an attempt to thwart the breathalyzer. It didn't work. The machine measured his blood alcohol at 0.165%. And because it's McDonald's third drunk driving offense, he faces up to 5 years in prison. Now, I don't know where you got the idea that eating toilet paper will help, but where he's going, he'll get all the toilet paper he can eat. Yeah. And some people in there might help him eat it. Britain's Tesco store chain is advertising a job opening that's never been seen in the country, a Christmas light untangler. The position will require a friendly, helpful demeanor, said a Tesco spokeswoman, oodles of patience, and of course, the innate knack to be able to untangle even the most scrambled of wires. The successful applicant must untangle a string of lights within 3 minutes without breaking any bulbs. What exactly do you have to put on your resume to get a job like that? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the stories ramp up every holiday season, someone trying to get into a house through a chimney, perhaps inspired by Santa Claus. Sometimes it's a burglar, sometimes it's a homeowner who locked themselves out. Invariably, they end up stuck and in need of rescue. Now, this year, the trend gets started with a blaze of glory. A homeowner in Huron, California, never heard anything suspicious until he built a fire in his fireplace. Once he lit it, he heard screaming. He ran around the house looking for a source of the distress until he realized it was coming from the chimney. He extinguished the fire and called 911. Firefighters smashed the chimney in a hurried rescue attempt, but the unfortunate man, who was unidentified, a suspected burglar, was already dead. You know, trying to break into a house through a chimney, some people don't realize that the movie Home Alone was a comedy, not a documentary. We have got to give this guy the Darwin Award because, you know, as we often say on this program, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Anyway, Let's get to our first guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? William D. Chalmers is back on the program. He's the event director for the Global Scavenger Hunt. It's an annual travel adventure that takes adventurous travelers to 10 countries over 23 days in a competitive scavenger hunt to exotic locales. William joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Peter. How are you? It's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you again, too. We do this, it seems to be, every couple of years, although you have this race, this race every year. This is now number what? The 12th edition?
This is number 12, and I remember talking to you before we actually did our first event, so we've come a long way with you.
Absolutely. Now, this one is taking place April the 15th to May the 7th of 2016. Tell us about this year's event and some of the things you've learned having done 11 of them already.
Ah, well, that's a good question, Peter. Thank you for asking. This event, every year is an exciting event. I originally thought this was a once-in-a-lifetime thing, but now we have global scavenger hunt groupies that come back every year because this is the way they want to experience the world, and they love the competition. They love the camaraderie with their fellow travelers from around the world, and they love the blind date aspect of it. One of the key aspects of this event is, yes, as you mentioned, we're going to go around the world in 23 days and visit 10 countries, but we don't tell people which 10 countries we're going to. And that's in a very exciting time for people. It's not so great for type A's who like to plan and be in control, but for people who love serendipity and are curious, it's an exciting situation.
Now, there's one stumbling block, I think, here in planning all of this thing. Since they don't know where they're going, how do you know what visas you need? Also, what shots you might need if you have no idea where you're going?
Well, that's a good question. Those are practical nuts and bolts, and those are two things that we do deal with every traveler that wants to participate, because we interview everybody for suitability because we want to have a great cocktail. The first one on visas, the world has become a much more open place. Even in the last 12 years, you asked me to reflect on what's happened in 12 years. The world is more open than it ever has been. Places like China and India now, even, you can get visas at the border on arrival, where 12 years ago you could not. So that is not an issue. There are still a few pockets of resistance, I like to call it, out there, Iran, Russia, North Korea. But, you know, my guess is we're not going to a couple of those places. So visas is not an issue. Shots is an issue for people, but I always tell folks, as long as they have their boosters up to date, their tetanus, diphtheria, that kind of stuff, their hep C, they're fine. We live in a real malaria-free zone unless you're going to five or six countries of the world. So malaria issue is not an issue anymore. And so, you know, we live in a different world than we did 12 years ago for travel. It's much easier than it ever has been.
You know, every time we have you on the program, Bill, I try to ask you where you're going on this trip. And, of course, you never tell me. But I actually think I've gotten somewhere this time, because you just listed four places you're not going.
That's true. You only got 196 other countries to guess where we are going, though.
Exactly. So I've narrowed it down quite a bit. Now, what are the average ages of the participants who take part in this?
Well, that's a good question. You know, our wheelhouse, as we like to call it for demographics, is between 38 and 58. And it's usually people that have been around the block a few times, are very curious about participating in the world. They want an authentic, challenging, and participatory event. We get a few more women than men, like 55, 45, and I think that's because of the cultural interaction aspect of it. It's not a hard adventure, it's a soft adventure of the mind. But we've had people as young as 13 years old participating with their grandmother, who was a great traveler. They did very well. And then we've had as old, I think it's 75, 76 years of age. So age isn't usually an issue. It's more of what your spirit of your mind is.
Okay, I know this is not a cheap endeavor to go on. You have 15 teams of two, and it's $25,000 per team entry. Having said that, I'm kind of surprised at the age group. And the reason why I say that is the age range you said is the average age range. I would have assumed that some people who were younger would be on the more adventurous side, more inclined to do this kind of trip than somebody, as you say, 38 to 58.
Well, and that is our demographic range, okay? We do get teams. Last year we had a couple teams in their 20s. So, you know, average and mean are very slippery things when you start talking about statistics, okay?
Right.
But you're right. We get a lot of folks who are younger, but unfortunately sometimes they have more will than wallet and they can't afford the entry fee. We try to find ways and creative ways for them to raise the funds to participate in it. But, you know, it's $400 a day. I mean, that's more than most can afford. But, you know, we have a good group of people. And when there's a will, there's a way. Travelers are very resourceful individuals. And when they really want to do something, they can figure it out. You know, traveling is a lifelong passion. And you make choices by traveling. You decide not to have a new big screen TV because you want to take a trip to Thailand for 2 months. And you make these choices that you'd rather have experiences than stuff.
Mm. Now, you mentioned that the world is getting to be a smaller place and things are getting easier. But also in some situations, and we've seen it just recently, the world is also getting somewhat scarier. What about the safety aspect when you plan this trip going around the world, taking into consideration some of the, you know, hot spots of the world where, unfortunately, there are things like terrorism, even in some major metropolitan centers?
Well, you know, last year we went around the world and we ended up, our last destination was Miami. And I told everybody when we were leaving Colombia to go to Miami that they were now going to the most dangerous portion of their trip. You know, Peter, we live in a 97% conflict-free zone. The illusion of security is around us every day when we get in a car to drive somewhere, which is you're more likely to get hurt on than traveling anywhere, and more likely to get hurt by, I don't think any Canadians have died in the last 15 years in a terrorist incident. And I know of only 5 or 6 Americans that have died in that same time period since 9/11 on foreign soil. And we're not talking about war zones. We're talking about actually terrorist incidents. It's your odds of something like that happening, although the media likes to magnify them, is very, very remote. And quite frankly, I think we're all big boys here, and we all understand that if someone's going to kill themselves, it's really hard to protect yourself against someone who's going to do something like that. But we live in a 97% conflict-free zone. I have no problem finding destinations around the world. We've been to 65 countries in the world, I think a dozen Middle Eastern countries. Obviously, we're not going to Syria. We're not going to Iraq. We're not going to Afghanistan. You know, the world is a safe place. The illusion of unsafeness that we want to live our lives in a bubble, and you simply can't do that.
Okay, so now we're up to 7 countries you're not going to. I'm going to get you down to, I'm going to nail you down to the ones we've got.
Okay. Here, I'll give you a few more. We're not going to Somalia. We're not going to Congo. We're not going to Ukraine. We're not going to Mongolia.
Okay, so I think we're up to 12 now. We mentioned, of course, that it is a scavenger hunt. Give us an idea of some of the things, you know, from previous examples, obviously. Give us an idea what kinds of things happen in the scavenger hunt part of this journey.
Well, that's the most authentic part of it and the participatory part. I mean, we want people, some of the fun ones, I mean, in broad strokes, one is taxi cab roulette, I like to call it, where they have to go into a taxi cab and ask the taxi cab driver where he takes his family to eat and go to that restaurant and have something that the taxi driver would eat. So they learn about the culture. They learn about neighborhoods that are out of the tourist bubble. One is blind taste test, where I like to get them to assemble 3 or 4 things, whether they're fruits or whether they're vegetables or whether they're beers or whether they're sodas or local snacks from a local grocery store, and taste them individually. I like the food on a stick challenge. Every country has food on a stick, and they have to go out and find some type of food on a stick. One of the great ones was they had to go to a marketplace, I think it was in Sri Lanka a couple years ago, and they had to buy food, and then they had to meet people while they were there. And some of them, it was a life-changing event for them in so many positive ways. They had to then find someone to take them and cook them a meal in their own home.
Wow. Technology is something that is being used more and more, and everyone's got their own personal computer. With the idea of doing the scavenger hunt and traveling around the world, do you allow people to take their cell phones with them?
Well, they can take their cell phones, but can't use it in the competition. I want people to trust strangers in strange lands and not make technology become a barrier between communications. I want them to ask questions. When they get lost, I want them to figure it out. I want them to use hand gestures to figure out how to use charades if necessary in their pidgin language of whatever it is they know of that thing. I want communications between people, and that's face-to-face. It has been a challenge, I will tell you that.
Mm. Okay, let me ask you this. The last time we had you on the program, you did mention the fact that you were writing a book. What's the status of that?
The book is out, actually. It was called America's Vacation Deficit Disorder, and Who Stole Our Vacation? And it was to our American friends. I go back and forth between Canada and the United States, Vancouver area and Santa Monica, California. And more in fact, talk to our American friends, they had issues with getting time off. And it prompted me to understand why that was. And it was a very interesting, illuminating research I did. And it was a lot of fun. I have had, it came out about a year and a half ago.
Hmm. So let's, getting back very quickly, because we're just about out of time. I want to make sure people get the information. If people want to take part in this, it's a 23-day around-the-world trip involving 15 teams of two. It's $25,000 per team for the entry fees, all international airfare, first-class hotels, 40% off meals, and special event-sponsored travel gear. People can find out more information by applying online. They can go to globalscavengerhunt.com. Is that correct?
That's right, Peter, and I thank you so much for having us on again. And one day, I'm going to get you on this trip.
We'll see. Thanks for being on the program, Bill.
Thank you.
William D. Chalmers, Event Director for the Global Scavenger Hunt. You can find out more information by going to their website at globalscavengerhunt.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0329, and you'll find all the links.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. If you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come on the program, Edward Meyer from Ripley's Believe It or Not is back on the show to share some weird and odd holiday-related stories on the program. Plus, we'll talk about the death of video stores. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Have you ever heard of the term tempting fate? It's really something you shouldn't do. Case in point, 25-year-old Brittany Leith miraculously came out of a horrible situation with the best possible luck. While driving home early in the morning in Long Island, Leith somehow managed to hit the center median and flip her vehicle completely over onto its roof. Other drivers came to her aid and helped her get out through a broken window. Incredibly, Leith seemed to be completely uninjured as she stood on the side of the road. That was when she decided that she absolutely had to retrieve her purse from the wreck. Her rescuers begged her not to cross the dark parkway, but before emergency personnel could arrive, Leith walked back out into traffic and was struck and killed instantly by a passing car. There is no report on what was actually in the purse. You know, for those of you who are religious, there's also another term. God lets you know when it's your time. He missed her the first time. Don't offer him a second chance. He rarely misses twice. And Florida police say they arrested a motorist accused of enjoying an ice-cold beer in full view of an officer driving in a marked patrol car. The Orlando Police Department said Officer Jose Sanchez was driving in a marked patrol car just before noon Saturday when he spotted a motorist, later identified as Edgar Cortez, sipping from what appeared to be a bottle of beer. As I passed the vehicle, I observed the driver drink from a bottle that appeared to resemble that of an alcoholic beverage, Sanchez wrote in his report. The bottle's contents appeared to be dark yellow in color, reasonably appearing to me to be the color of beer. Sanchez found Cortez to be in possession of an unfinished bottle of Corona Extra Beer, a loaded 9mm pistol, and a small bag of marijuana. Cortez was charged with driving with an open container, carrying a concealed firearm, and armed possession of marijuana with intent to sell. He was taken to jail and later released after posting bail. Well, he certainly hit the trifecta, which is also the name of a federal agency. You know, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. Nice going, pal. And after certain takeoffs and landings were delayed on November 7th at Paris's Orly Airport, several days after the terrorist attacks, by the way, a backtrace on the problem forced the airport to disclose that its crucial Decor computer system still runs on Windows 3.1 software, which was introduced back in 1992. Decor's function is to estimate the spacing between aircraft on fog-bound, visually impossible runways, and apparently it must shut down whenever the airport scrambles to find an available 3.1 qualified technician. They probably have to dig out a technician who's in a home somewhere. And you know, I understand sticking with what works. This show, the Stuff File program, is assembled using two computers, one running Windows XP and the other running Windows Vista. Who needs upgrades? Mind you, I'm not trying to land planes here. 62-year-old Charles Smith is set to drive municipal buses for Broward County, Florida, until he retires in 2020, even though his record includes 14 accidents in a recent 5-year period, and apparently not enough for discipline in that, according to contract rules, not more than 4 were labeled preventable in any 2 consecutive years. The bus driver's union president told the South Florida Sun Sentinel that he can't figure out why some drivers just get into more accidents than others. Elsewhere in transit news, notorious serial New York Joy driver Darius McCollum, who was 50, commandeered yet another bus and was arrested on November 11th. He faces jail time, just as he has already served for more than 24 bus and train borrowing incidents. You know, based on the news reports of McCollum over the years, he nonetheless might be a better bus driver than Charles Smith. Just think about that. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police in suburban Sydney, Australia, were prepared for a scene of domestic mayhem when they answered an emergency call on the weekend. Neighbors had reported hearing a woman's cries and a man yelling, "I'm going to kill you," along with the sound of furniture being thrown across the apartment. When officers arrived, according to a post on the police department's Facebook page, the man who answered the door said he was home alone. When questioned, the police said the male became very sheepish. "It was a spider," he said, "a really big one." "What about the woman who was heard screaming?" the police asked. The man said the high-pitched shrieks heard by neighbors were his own. "Yeah, sorry, that was me. I really, really hate spiders." You know, I guess when he sees spiders, he sounds like high-voiced Peyton Manning from those DirecTV commercials. Has he ever thought of singing barbershop? Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff All program, shall we? It's the holiday season, and the folks at Ripley's Believe It or Not are sharing some seasonal stories that you won't believe. It was just back in September when we had on the show Edward Meyer, the VP of Exhibits and Archives from Ripley's Believe It or Not, with the release of their latest book entitled Ripley's Believe It or Not, Eye-Popping Oddities. So we thought we'd have him back, this time, in a festive holiday mood. Edward joins us on the line right now from Florida. Happy holidays, Edward.
Happy holidays. Thank you for having us back. I wasn't realizing it was that soon that I, or recent that I was on the show, but always good to talk to my friends in Montreal and the rest of Canada.
Always good to talk to you as well. So we're looking specifically at holiday stuff. I mean, you've got the gamut of everything at Ripley's. What do you have that is of a holiday nature to share with us?
All right, so I'm going to give you one that's not in the book first. This is a Montreal exclusive for you.
Oh, great.
So every year we produce a Christmas card.
Right.
And in a Ripley's Believe It or Not cartoon format. And this year's Christmas card is going to say Santa Claus would have to visit 822 homes per second, traveling at 650 miles a second in order to deliver all of the presents on Christmas Eve. So our friends at NORAD, combined with a university math professor, have done the math for us, and I hope that just baffles everybody to even think about that. But apparently, you know, if those speeds could be done, Santa could actually deliver presents around the world on Christmas Eve.
Well, you know,
believe it or not,
you know, Santa would be a lot faster if he didn't stop for those milk and cookies at every house.
There you go. And I was just watching a bit of TV the other night that says in England they give them rum. You know, so I'm not sure why we're only giving them milk. We're not appreciating them quite enough.
Well, the rum would explain Rudolph's red nose.
All right, there you go. Well, talking about Rudolph's red nose, one of my favorite Christmas stories, or seasonal stories, at least, in the book, page 68, the Lapp people of Lapland, northern Finland and northern Norway, are treating their reindeer with glow-in-the-dark paint on their antlers to prevent them being hit by cars and traffic at night. So Rudolph may be out of a job real soon. If we've got antlers that glow in the dark, we could do the whole sleigh and be a little bit brighter than just one nose. Glow-in-the-dark reindeer antlers in Lapland.
Glow-in-the-dark antlers. Wow. Now, who came up with that idea?
Well, you know, the people of Lapland are indigenous people, sort of similar to the Inuit there in Canada, but they actually train, domesticate reindeers. They use them for travel. They use them for meat, milk, etc., furs for their clothes. So it's a near and dear animal to them that they want to protect and do their best to, you know, prevent accidents. So as a safety feature, this is the solution. And I think it's kind of cool. Picture in the book is kind of freaky with them, you know, literally glowing in the dark red and green Christmas colors.
Wow. Now, one of the things that's always interesting about the holiday period is the tradition of what one will have at Christmas as far as a meal is concerned. I understand it's quite the surprise in Japan.
Well, for almost 40 years now, based on an advertising campaign, and I actually have met the man that created this sensation, Kentucky Fried Chicken is the meal of choice Christmas Eve in Japan. And this has been going on since the mid-70s. You know, started as a gimmick, started as a little fad, but now has really caught on. And just like Americans want to have turkey at Thanksgiving, the Japanese have to have KFC for Christmas Eve.
Wow. And no one at KFC thought to do that in the homeland? I mean, some marketing genius in the States hasn't come up with this one?
The guy's name is, what is his name? No, it's escaping me. Bill something. But he lives in Bangkok, Thailand. and he has the rights to both Pizza Hut and Kentucky Fried Chicken in all of Asia. And single-handedly, he's a billionaire at this point, based on, you know, bringing American fast food to the Orient. And he did this as a marketing ploy when they first brought the rights to Japan. And it's just caught on and become a Christmas tradition. And for, you know, for me, Christmas is all about traditions. We're always trying to, you know, do the same thing as our parents did or our grandparents did. And a lot of the Christmas traditions we have in America are German to begin with, including Christmas trees in the first place. And one of the things in our book, we've got a couple here about Christmas trees, but I like in Lithuania, a guy building a Christmas tree from 1,100 empty champagne bottles, 13.5-foot tall Christmas tree, all made from sparkly bottles. 3 years to collect the bottles.
Now, are they glued together or just on top of each other? How has he put this together? Like, is it fragile?
Well, it's got a metal framework. And again, okay. My cultural reference is the Deep South, Mississippi in particular, tradition of bottle trees, which are supposed to keep out evil spirits. The sun sparkles on the colors to blind them, and then they get trapped inside the bottle. So the Ray Charles film of a few years ago had a little scene of one in his early life. But it's relatively, you know, I don't know, common's probably not the right word, but, you know, they're visible in the Deep South. It's not a fluke, one-of-a-kind sort of thing. But they base on a metal frame, you know, that's got some welding to make it look like a tree, and then the bottles are on little spikes as if they were branches. And
wow.
It's, again, it's not every day, but it's not one of a kind. But this guy's built one 13.5 feet tall, all green bottles, and shaped like a Christmas tree. It's pretty cool. Champagne bottles, even at that. So. Yeah.
Now, I want to go back to the Kentucky Fried Chicken thing for a minute, because what the guy has done in Asia is tie a commercial product to the holiday season. And I guess what he's done is very similar to, several decades ago now, well, I guess almost 100 years ago now, what Coca-Cola did tying Santa Claus to their product.
Right. A cartoon artist named Thomas Nash is responsible for first having drawn Santa for Coca-Cola, but drawing him as we think of Santa today.
Right.
Big fat guy with a white beard, little glasses, and jolly ho-ho-ho. Created by an American caricaturist, and Coca-Cola made the best of it. And some of those early pictures are worth thousands of dollars today. You know, the collectibles, tea trays and postcards, etc., with the early Thomas Nash Santa Claus.
Now, I understand that look of Santa is very different to one that you guys have found, where Santa is covered from head to toe in tattoos.
All right. Well, I wasn't sure if we were going to talk about this one. I would have left it to the end because it's just like it's wrong on so many levels. Okay.
Well, we're near the end, so we're there.
Victor Martins of Brazil, and this guy, you know, he kind of looks like Santa, but maybe a little worse for wear. But he's got the big white beard, he's got the costume, and the little glasses. And he has 94% of his body tattooed. So he's almost completely illustrated man. And it started with a couple Santa Claus Christmas-type tattoos, but he's got a little bit of everything on there, and including one of Elvis under his underarm, I think is weirdly placed. But this is not a pretty Santa Claus, let's just put it that way. But a full-page illustration in our new book, Eye-Popping Oddities, it's page 245. And I've had a lot of comedy about this picture because it's just like you don't want to see this Santa in your neighborhood store.
You know, there are a host of pictures out there of children who, when they see Santa Claus, are just bawling their eyes out. They're terrified. I would assume this is the case with this guy.
I think so. Hopefully he doesn't show the tattoos to little kids, keeps them under the suit, but I think he would scare most people.
I'm looking at the picture right now on, as you say, page 245. Yeah, it's a little terrifying.
It's a little terrifying. On a friendlier note, perhaps, and unfortunately there isn't a picture of this, but on page 201, we got a guy named Duncan Titmarsh for 32 days, built himself a Santa Claus complete with sleigh and reindeer, 750,000 Lego bricks, 32 days in the making. So
wow.
There's Christmas dedication if I ever heard of it.
And we will end on that note. The book is called Ripley's Believe It or Not, Eye-Popping Oddities, and we're only focusing this time around on holiday stories, but there's a host of things in the book, not holiday related, but eye-popping nonetheless. Edward, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to you.
Merry Christmas. 1,000 stories, 500 photos, a great gift at this time of year.
A great gift indeed. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, bye-bye.
Edward Meyer from Ripley's Believe It or Not. The latest book is Ripley's Believe It or Not, Eye-Popping Oddities. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0329, and you'll find links to Ripley's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. We recently received a note from someone who shared a story that reveals one more way that America's problem with excessive litigation is hurting all of us, even those of us who have never been sued. This kind-hearted person had taken a baby carriage to a local charity, hoping to help a young family. However, she was surprised to be told she couldn't donate it. Even though it was an extremely nice carriage and in like-new condition, the charity said it doesn't accept any baby items like that from anyone because of fear of getting sued. Isn't that a shame? This isn't an isolated case, either. All across the United States, young families in need who could benefit from the generosity of others are being told they have to use their rent or food money to buy new strollers, carriages, and beds when perfectly good used ones are available. Let's be fair. In this season of giving, it's troubling to hear stories about people who want to help others and who are told they can't, simply because of America's ongoing lawsuit problem. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about the death of video stores. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. And I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program I also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. During an exhibition at a gallery in Palm Beach, Florida, the gallery owner, a jeweler, reported that $6,000 worth of jewelry was missing. He had noticed a couple hanging around just before the items went missing, and a police officer who heard their description realized he had seen the couple in the area and he tracked them down. When the cop confronted them, 24-year-old Megan O'Hara allegedly admitted she had the jewelry in her purse. "If I knew that they cost that much, I wouldn't have taken it," she told the officer. O'Hara and her companion, 19-year-old David Zakowski, were arrested. Officers gathering evidence at the gallery were shown the guest book. O'Hara and Zakowski had allegedly signed Meg in the book and included O'Hara's real phone number and a fake email address, wedidn'ttakeit@gmail.com. Wow. I guess you'll have to change your email address to imtoostupidtobeonline@gmail.com. Anyway, let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Recently on Vox Online, I saw an excellent piece written by Dennis Perkins. It was on the demise of the video store business in general, and in particular on the closing of a store that he had personally worked at for years. Dennis is also a contributor to avclub.com, and he joins us on the line via Skype from Portland, Maine. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
As I said in the introduction, it's an excellent piece that you wrote. It's on Vox for those who want to take a look at it. And I've also put a link in on our website so people can check it out there. You worked at a video store for 25 years and I believe 15 years at one particular location before it closed?
That's right. Yeah. Right out of college, I ended up at one store which closed after about 10 years. And then Videoport, I was there from turn of the century until when it closed back in this summer, 2015.
Okay, so obviously it's clear that you are a film buff, but I'm just kind of curious, how did your ideas or thoughts about films change over the years because you were working at a video store and you got to come in contact with the general population who were looking for films to watch?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, film buff is a good word. You know, my entire life, for whatever reason, who knows why people are drawn to the things they are, but it's certainly the thing I was always most interested in and watched and read about. And as soon as I'm old, so as soon as video stores came into being, they became, you know, the sort of a place that I would feel very at home. And then after college, I ended up working in one. I just kind of fell into it. And I guess the thing that changed the most is that if you're working in a video store, you're not only, you know, as I always had been, as far as I can remember, you're not only thinking about movies all the time and watching movies, but you're also talking about movies, you're handling movies, you're exchanging ideas with coworkers and customers. And, you know, it becomes even more of a physical reality in your life, I guess.
Now, as you know, time does march on. You know, they don't make buggy whips anymore, for instance. But I'm just curious, and I think I get a sense of it by reading your article. What do you think, because we have streaming now, for instance, we have different ways of seeing movies, but what do you think we're losing with the demise of the video store?
Sure. I mean, yeah, that was sort of the whole reason for the article, I guess. Was just trying to talk about, what it is that the video store had that was unique that streaming doesn't have. And I recognize that streaming is not the future; it's the present. It's the now. It's here, and it's the video store is the past. I think the main premise of my article was that what we're losing is twofold. I mean, one, it is a personal connection with movies and with other people, the people at the store, the people who are you develop a relationship with. As I wrote in the article, you know, I when the store was closing, once we announced it was closing, our loyal customers were just, they were very bereft. They were sad because not only was the store going, but also a lot of them had become, if not dependent, at least certainly a big fan of the service we provided in sort of bouncing ideas off each other and knowing who they were, what they wanted, and what they might like that they didn't know about. And the other part I think that we're losing is that going to a video store, like going to the movie theater, is a conscious choice that you make, a commitment to a movie. You go and you look and you talk and you pick it out and you choose it and then you take it home. It's an appointment. It's a commitment you make based on a conscious choice. Whereas, as with cable and with TV and with the internet and with everything else, movies on streaming are generally they're what's on. They're part of they're another rectangular screen that's vying for your attention, and it's a lot less likely to have you're a lot less likely to have a as strong a connection, I think, to movies that are online.
Okay, so the second answer, part of your answer, I think we can agree upon is, for the most part, with the death of the video store, is dying off itself. But the first part, the community involvement part of it, is there a way of replicating some of that in a new way, maybe an online way, so that there is still a connection with film buffs and people who are in the know about movies and people who like to discuss movies? Is that still possible? Is there a new way of doing that? Or will there be a new way of doing that?
Sure. I mean, you know, the internet is good at at certain things, and one of them is certainly, you know, I guarantee there's more film writing being done now than there ever has been, you know, with online, you know, websites like, you know, the, you know, IMDb and you know, message boards and people putting up their own websites and, you know, and with social media and, you know, so the conversation is still going on. I think the thing that the video store had that was unique, or has if you're lucky enough to still have one, is it kind of concentrates it. It's a centralized, localized kind of hub of movie knowledge and movie, you know, conversation that's centralized. It's less diffuse than you're gonna find online. It's easier to go to a video store and build a personal relationship with it.
Here, you talk about the involvement in going to a video store. You can go, for instance, I'll use Netflix as an example. I mean, there are lots of jokes online. There are comedy routines about it, about how people can literally spend an hour not watching anything, but just flipping through the titles of what is available without the possibility of making up their mind as to what they want to see. There's not a shall we say, an excitement level about everything at your fingertips. You know, it's like that old song, 500 channels on, but nothing on.
Right. Yeah. I think that's true. And I think, you know, not to get too nuts and bolts about Netflix specifically, but in doing research for, you know, the, not only, you know, my daily life when I was trying to keep our video store alive, but also in writing that article on Vox was, you know, there's a lot of junk on Netflix, and that's by design. You know, they need content, and it has to be cost effective, and they have a lot of their content comes as part of package deals with things that you know, God bless you if you want to see some of those movies, but generally there is, you know, kind of fodder to, as you say, just, you know, fill up that catalog, that endless catalog of things. But a lot of them are throw-ins, you know, so with companies, you know, if you want, say, The Hobbit, you're going to take these other 10 movies, you know, because it's profitable for the company to have them released somewhere. Right. But a good video store, and again, I'm talking about, you know, again, no offense to the late Blockbusters of the world, but we're talking about
independent,
know, video stores, independent video stores with staff by people who care and owners who care about movies as something other than, you know, product. You know, what a good video store will have more movies, and they'll have more movies than Netflix has at any one time, and they'll have a curated selection of movies, I guess.
Now, as one of the questions I asked earlier, and I'll kind of re-ask that, and, you know, with the 25 years you spent working in video stores, did your, even though you were a film buff to start with, did your taste in films broaden because of the experience you had being in the video store as an employee?
Absolutely. I mean, there's certainly, you know, I like to pride myself on the fact that I came in as an annoying kind of know-it-all about movies, because, you know, I grew up reading everything I could, seeing everything I could. But in a really good video store, it's a delight that there are people who know more than you or have little pockets of expertise in areas and in films that you weren't aware. That's the thing I think Videoport, that was the name of our store, sorry, video stores in general, good video stores had, those little pockets of enthusiasm that could open up a whole new experience for you that you might not have come across otherwise, just as you say, just kind of flipping through the Netflix catalog, that endless stream of who knows.
Well, again, the story is a great one. As I mentioned earlier, the headline, I worked in a video store for 25 years. Here's what I learned as my industry died. It's on Vox Online. People can also go to my website and find the link to it. Dennis, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us. And, you know, maybe it's quite possible that someone reading the story might have an aha moment and come up with an idea that might marry the two worlds of what we do now and what we used to do, and keep the better parts of what used to be a video store alive in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. I've had some people, customers, former customers, and some people from reading the review kind of reach out to me on Twitter and Facebook and kind of try to keep that conversation going, asking, you know, just for recommendations. So that's fun. I miss it.
Well, thanks very much, Dennis, for being on the program with us.
Thanks, Peter.
Dennis Perkins, who wrote an excellent article on video stores for Vox. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0329, and you'll find links to Dennis's story on Vox and also links to his page at avclub.com so you can check out his work. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A crew of masked home invaders struck an Orlando, Florida family in October and were preparing a haul of about $100,000 in cash and property when one of the perps got testy with the family's barking dog. "Back up, princess," the masked man said, inadvertently revealing that he was on a first-name basis with the dog and therefore a family acquaintance. The victims, piecing together other clues, identified Christopher Jarrah, who was soon arrested. Now, why, oh why, when you're committing a masked home invasion, would you yell out the name of the family dog when you probably already know their bark is worse than their bite? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0329. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0329. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.